This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Who would have thought that a distracted mouse piloting a steamboat could mark the start for commercial success of a whole new genre of film? Steamboat Willie was not the first animated film, but it was the screen debut for Mickey Mouse, whose popularity gave momentum to animator Walt Disney and opened up a universe of movie magic. And it has not slowed down. From Snow White to today's CGI-enhanced characters, the artistic and technical feats of animation have only grown more impressive in the feature film industry. And our film experts are here now to talk about the singular magic of animated films. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
And Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Hiya, Frank.
We should talk about this and kind of talk about the beginning of animated film, and we're going to get in trouble right away because, you know, we start talking about the first animated film, you get into problems.
Let's
with
not do
what's
it.
A feature and what's animated, but how far back does this go?
Well, animation dates to the early 1900s. Film really started in the 1890s, and when I think about some of the different kinds of animation that were happening in cinema's first decade or so, I think about amazing films like The Teddy Bears, which is a 1907 Thomas Edison Company film that I love to show my film history students at NC State because it's this live-action version of the teddy bears. And then partway through the film, we get this animated spectacle of these teddy bears that do this kind of couple-minute-long crazy dance number, and it's all stop-motion animation, and it's like the students are always like, it's breakdancing. They invented breakdancing. And it's true. It's this kind of wonderful stuff. And so that's one form of animation. And then you also have kind of coincident with it things like lightning sketches, someone like Winsor McCay with Gertie the Dinosaur, which is a kind of live action film where all of a sudden he starts drawing and then you see this dinosaur come to life. You go into the world of the drawings. And so animation allowed early filmmakers this true rupture with representing things that were in the world because it was everything that you could imagine and draw and render.
Were they always for kids?
No. And actually, Winsor McCay toured with his films and interacted with them on stage so that he would command the dinosaur to do something, and then the dinosaur would apparently obey him. There were some incredibly creative animators. One of my favorites is Ladislaw Starevich, who did stop-motion animation with dead insects. Certainly something that has never been attempted again. And someone like Lottie Reininger doing paper cut animation with the Adventures of Prince Ahmed.
It's
really
a lot easier
remarkable
if you just let
things.
The bug run around. You know, don't kill it, and
but
it'll move
can't
by itself.
But you can't control the bug.
These bugs acted out melodramas, so it was
as they often do.
Well, there are a lot of them. They are all charming in their own ways. Why don't we get right to our first one that listeners have picked as their favorite animated films?
My name is Tim Botta. I'm from Siler City, North Carolina, and my pick for the best animated movie is The Old Mill from 1937. It's a Walt Disney film. What I love about this film is just as an emotional story, it shows a lot of empathy for the characters, which are all animals. And I like the idea of acknowledging the emotional lives of animals. It was also a very innovative film. It was made before Snow White was made, and they tried out a lot of things like a multi-plane camera to get a three-dimensional effect. And they were really going for heightened realism. There's a mother bird who's flattening herself over her nest as this wheel comes down. There are the eyes of these frightened mice, and you just feel for the characters throughout the film as they face this terrible storm hiding out in this abandoned mill.
There's Tim Botta talking about the 1937 Disney film, The Old Mill.
Well, this was a silly symphony. It was a series of films that Walt Disney made, utilizing lots of times classical music. And in fact, this uses One Day When We Were Young by Johann Strauss II from the operetta The Gypsy Baron, from a day when people were much more familiar with classical music. And supposedly it was the favorite animated film of the Japanese animator Miyazaki, who we'll talk about a little bit later
And these silly symphonies, they started in the late 1920s after the coming of sound, which of course you need in order to have a symphony on film. But they also exploited Technicolor, which was a technology that Disney had the lock on in animation for a couple of years. So in 1932, he produces Flowers and Trees, which is also this just super sweet story about romance and violence in the plant community. And so you can see some of the tropes that come out in the films about anthropomorphizing and making us feel, as this listener just discussed, for animals or plants, being worked out in these shorter pieces that were incredibly popular.
Yeah, and the music was great stuff. I learned to appreciate what we would call classical music by through Disney and Warner Brothers cartoons.
Bugs exactly. Bunny.
You're
so
not
many
the
people
only one.
Did.
Oh, yeah, great stuff. Well, speaking of music, Disney and animation, let's listen to this.
This is Carmine Scavo from Greenville, North Carolina. And my favorite animated film is Fantasia, which was also the first film I ever saw in a theater with my dad in the 1950s. The final sequence of Night on Bald Mountain was so scary to me that I had nightmares for weeks afterwards, so I'm not real sure my dad was particularly happy to have taken me to that. The sequence has Satan coming alive on Bald Mountain as the evening starts, and he calls up the dead souls from out of the mountain, and they invade this village, and it continues until dawn when a bell rings, and Satan then goes back into the dome of the mountain, and monks then troop up the mountain to a cathedral. Some 40 years later, I showed the DVD to my young son, who had exactly the same reaction to the Night on Bald Mountain sequence. And so we watched Fantasia without the sequence of, quote, the scary bat, as he called it, for many years afterwards.
Carmine Scavo's pick is the 1940 Disney film Fantasia.
It's another film without any dialogue in it, which links it back to the whole silent era as well. But the part that I always loved the most about Fantasia was The Sorcerer's Apprentice, where Mickey Mouse conjures up all of these brooms and mops and buckets to do his bidding. And we had 78 records of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which I would play. And then I would be the wizard and boss my brother around. One of the things for which I'm sure he's never forgiven me.
I mean, I really think of this as a radical film, because the idea of doing an over 2-hour classical music, no conventional narrative film that took over 2 years to make and over $2 million to produce is, I mean, that is a visionary, risky proposition. And, you know, in fact, the sound was so important that Disney had some very special sound systems created and actually would install them at theaters. And this, in the first run, this film only played in like the big cities that could be outfitted with this. So this was an all-in investment in music and the latest animation technology.
Well, wasn't the orchestra conducted by Leopold Stokowski, who was at the time the most famous conductor in America of the New York Philharmonic? I think I could be wrong.
But even so, if you think about it, I mean, again, what you just said, the idea that anybody would sit for 2 hours
with an intermission, right?
No doubt.
And watch a story that has no narrative,
right?
And just listen to the music and be dazzled, young and old.
Yeah.
But of course, that links back to the vaudeville tradition, which was not quite dead in 1940.
Well, and the roots of silly symphonies. And so this was obviously a nascent idea that just got more and more ambitious. And I was reading some press accounts from the late 1930s about when this was being produced, it was done in a lot of secrecy. And so this was kind of a big surprise for everyone to see what it actually was. And it blew people away.
A lot of things, you know, but this is also a period where animators are experimenting with all kinds of things, but the kind of cultural sensitivity that we've grown into today was not necessarily present. And so you get these very troublesome films, in some ways, films that people loved for various reasons. You take a film like Dumbo, for instance, that has that racist moment in where the crows are kind of making the jokes about an elephant, a flying elephant. It's smart language, but the fact that you've used black vernacular in crows mm-hmm. now makes it quite objectionable. You know, what do we do about it? Because if you saw that at a more innocent time, you would have a right to love the film, particularly if you weren't the minority who is offended by this. Right?
What do you do about these things? It's something, as someone who shows films, I have to deal with yeah. all the time. How do you contextualize it? Is there a way to contextualize it?
I think there is, because not seeing them, I don't think, is the right answer, which is kind of what happened with Song of the South, which right. is the Disney film that has been, I think, most suppressed in some ways. But, I mean, I think you have to be aware, and it's not that it was a more innocent time. It was just a time in which certain kind of racist beliefs were considered more, acceptable. Right. And so, but I don't think that means you shouldn't see them. I just think you have to be able to have honest conversations about them and acknowledge that they are offensive to us in ways that they were not as widely offensive at the time. Although they certainly were offensive to plenty of people.
Movies on the Radio today, animated films. We're talking to Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon, and we will come back with more of your picks and theirs on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio with Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon. Today, it is Movies on the Radio, time to get your picks, and we are talking about animated films today. Here's another pick.
I'm Bucky Grimm from Mount Airy, Maryland, and the film I chose was the 1939 animated classic Gulliver's Travels by the Fleischer brothers, Max and Dave, through Paramount Studios. I was a child of the 60s, and I'd seen many of the Hanna-Barbera, Terry Toons, Tex Avery, and the light cartoons of the day, and enjoyed them. The difference in Gulliver's Travels to me from the other films, cartoons tended to be very caricature-like. Even as a child, I realized that they weren't as realistic, but there was something about Gulliver's Travels, the way the giant moved and the other characters. They may have been a stretch as to real people, but they seemed more real to me as opposed to the other cartoons that I had seen.
Come now, don't let my size frighten you. You, Your Majesty, surely you're not afraid of me. Well, good. Then let me present myself. My name is Gulliver, Your Majesty. Lemuel Gulliver, a shipwrecked sailor. At your service.
Well, welcome to Lilliput, Mr. Gulliver. Mr. Gulliver, can you fight?
Well, Your Majesty, I can lick anybody my size.
There's Lemuel Gulliver, Bucky Grimm's pick from 1939, Gulliver's Travels.
Well, I looked up the New York Times review of this film from when it came out, and I thought it was so interesting because it compares it to Snow White, which is, of course, the Disney film from 1937. And it said that film, Snow White, was really made for adults. And it said this film, they could praise it because it was really made for kids and it would not scare kids to death. But it also says that it's so inferior in terms of the aesthetics compared to Snow White. So it's kind of interesting to think about the way that these films were being talked about and considered for their audiences at the time.
Well, that used to be on TV when I was a kid, although I only watched it in black and white because we didn't have a color TV. And I remember that the characterizations just seemed so flat compared to a Disney movie, and that's why it didn't seem as compelling.
Well, it's interesting because if you think about it as more realistic, the way our listeners talked about it, it was in a way more realistic, representational.
Yes.
But when I think the Times is talking about the aesthetic, it's all of those other kind of glorious
and it's the fantasy.
And the fantasy of it that wasn't there. Your pick is Duck Amuck.
Yes, Marcia speaking here.
Marcia.
Duck Amuck, Warner Brothers, amazing. If you have not seen this, look this up. This is a Warner Brothers animation from 1953 by Chuck Jones, the amazing staff animator, and it features Daffy Duck.
And I've never been so humiliated in all my life.
Look, Mac, just what's going on around here? Let's get organized, hmm? How about some scenery? That's dandy. Ho, ho, that's rich, I'll say. Now, how about some color, stupid? Hey! Not me, you swap artist! Well, where's the rest of me? It isn't as though I haven't lived up to my contract. Goodness knows. And goodness knows it isn't as though I haven't kept myself trim. Goodness knows. I've done that. That's strange. All of a sudden, I don't quite feel like myself. Oh, I feel all right. And yet Hey! You know better than that!
So this whole cartoon is Daffy getting in a fight with his animator, who he can't see, of course, who's erasing him and putting him into all kinds of inappropriate scenarios. And so he goes through this whole thing. And spoiler alert, the brilliance of this is at the end, when he finally says, "You have to show yourself," it's Bugs Bunny who says, "Ain't I a stinker?" And so it's this fantastic, it's self-reflexive, very witty, visually stunning piece.
The Warner Brothers cartoons from this era are just perfect. You know, 6-minute works of art. You know, it's really hard in many ways to choose a favorite. And you have to give a lot of credit to Mel Blanc, who did all the voices.
Man.
And Carl Stallings, who did the amazing music for all of these.
Mel Blanc, my hero. That guy. That guy's the reason I'm in radio. I thought I could do that.
Wow.
When I couldn't, I took this job.
There you go.
Because I can't do the thing I really wanted to do. It's great stuff. And also, in 1953, Meta already doing commentary on the whole business. And, of course, the objectification of ducks and having to keep slim in order to keep his job.
And why were it always the ducks that were angry? I mean, Donald Duck was also angry.
That's right. Who knows where all that came from? Speaking of animated animals, here's our next pick.
My name is Allison Cosberg, and I'm director of the Nickelodeon Theater in Columbia, South Carolina, and I'm calling for there. And my pick for my favorite animated film was the Rankin and Bass 1982 film, The Last Unicorn, which is based on Peter Beagle's novel of the same title. And one of the reasons that I love the film so much, which I saw for the first time as a childhood, is that in addition to its really unique and compelling visual style, it deals with really sophisticated emotional themes. So the protagonist looks around one day to realize she is the last unicorn, but also that the world is really changing and that society has less of an ability to recognize magic. But it also particularly captured my imagination as a young woman because the female characters are incredibly well-developed, striking, and oftentimes dangerous, but even their danger really stems from a need to survive in a world that can be very traumatic for women, which feels very topical and contemporary even now. So in addition to the eponymous unicorn, she also encounters a character named Mommy Fortuna, who's voiced by Angela Lansbury, a kind of hardened woman who's been traveling named Molly Grew as well. And they're often contrasted to the sort of false magic of a group of male characters who depend upon really superficial illusion or whose power stems from kind of trying to suppress the female characters that they meet.
You can't come with us. We're on a quest.
Can't I? Ask her.
Never! I, Shmendrick the magician, forbid it! And be wary of rousing a wizard's wrath! Rousing a wizard's... Be wary of making a magician angry! If I chose, I could turn you into a frog!
I should laugh myself sick. Oh, have sense, man. What were you going to do with the last unicorn in the world? Keep her in a cage?
Oh, you don't even know where we're going.
Do you think it matters to me?
We are journeying to King Hagrid's country to find the Red Bull.
Well, you're going the wrong way.
Should have stopped and asked for directions.
Yeah, and The Last Unicorn is voiced by Mia Farrow, and all the music in this film is by America. And this is a film I loved as a kid, and I just rewatched it, and it's a wacky ride, and I really think that those comments from the listener were very astute about it. But it's very much a timepiece of 1982.
Is it sad?
Yeah, there's some sadness in
I
it. Yeah, she's
remember
The Last Unicorn.
That's the last
I seem
unicorn.
To remember it being sort of overwhelmingly sad.
I was not overwhelmed by the sadness, but you may be.
Maybe this is an adult.
The red bull
is
pretty
kids.
Scary.
And I saw it as a kid.
I mean, it's a scary thing to think about, and it's also very, very palpable, the idea that we've lost the whole concept of magic, and it's in the hands of people now who are not very
bright.
I still
want to meet a unicorn one day.
There's a... you just... right there. And now, Laura, your pick. You're not getting that out of your head today.
Thank you so much, Frank. I actually rewatched a bunch of Wallace and Gromit's last night, so I already have it in my head. Wallace is a inventor who loves cheese and crackers, and Gromit is his long-suffering dog. And they're done with claymation, which is a very hands-on kind of process by Nick Park and Aardman Animations. And my favorite thing about these is that Gromit the dog has so many subtle expressions of emotion. You would never think that just a lump of clay could really convey as much as Gromit's face does.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. And so you think you're being dazzled by the wacky inventions that Wallace is always putting together and poor Gromit is having to test. But you're absolutely right. The subtlety of those takes to the camera with his expression is just pretty amazing.
These are so charming. I remember when they came out on VHS tape, the shorts, like a wrong shave and
a close shave,
wrong trousers. Or the wrong shave and the close trousers. And I just remember like watching them over and over again and circulating the tape. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So
good. Cracking contraptions, for instance.
We have left off. The trolley has cleared the garden on its 13th mission to the shops. Set guidance control to manual. Righto. Take a left on Stockton Avenue and proceed to the pack and save. Begin cheese acquisition, aisle 2. Easy does it. Steady, lad. It's the wrong cheese, Gromit. Go for the big one. Whee-hey! Ha-ha! Well done, lad. Bring him home.
Shopper 13, a clip from that, Wallace and Gromit from Cracking Contraptions, a series released in 2002.
And one of his favorite cheeses is Wensleydale. And I can't tell you how excited I was the first time I saw it in Whole Foods. Wensleydale, I said in the aisle.
You were probably not the only one overheard by the cheese
mongers. It's a whole course. Everybody started singing. Ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba. Well, there are other animated films, and let's move on to our very next clip.
Hi, I'm Chuck Samuels. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina.
I'm Marilyn Samuels. I'm 12 years old. Yeah.
And our favorite animated movie is The Incredibles from 2004. My wife and I saw this movie before we even had kids and went to the theater and saw it, and we thought it was just the coolest thing. We loved the animation style. We loved the sort of mid-century modern styling of a lot of the movie. And then
I really liked it because it's kind of really fun, and also it's not super serious all the time.
Is that everybody?
Yeah, that's everyone.
It better be. Can't you put this out? I can't lay down a layer thick enough. It's evaporating too fast.
Well, what that mean?
It means it's hot, and I'm dehydrated, Bob.
You're out of ice? You can't run out of ice. I thought you could use the water in the air.
There is no water in this air. What's your excuse? Run out of muscle?
I can't just go smash it through walls. The building's getting weaker by the second. It's going to come down on top of us.
I wanted to go bowling.
And I think the other thing that's great is that it's funny how there's a lot of really great, really funny family interactions that go on in the movie.
Bob, it's time to engage. Do something.
Want me to intervene? Okay, I'm intervening!
Sister, let go of your brother!
Get the door!
The 2004 Disney Pixar film, The Incredibles.
This film also actually had a fashion designer in charge of designing their uniforms named Edna, who I think was voiced by Brad Bird, the animator, who's kind of made to look like Edith Head, designer of classic Hollywood. And this is something that always would bug me in any superhero movie. Where do their costumes come from?
And this film tells
you. Except once you saw Spider-Man sewing his own costume, which I was really happy to see.
Well, that's good. Well, this also brings us to this moment. We've actually crossed a line here, and we're into a new era of animation, and that is CGI, ushered in by Toy Story. Nobody picked that one, but that was a pretty pivotal moment in the history of animation, eh?
Yes.
I
think when we get to these blockbuster films that everybody's seeing, and I think one of the appeals of a film like Toy Story and The Incredibles is that adults and children can both get something out of them and enjoy them. And certainly if you're a parent and you're having to watch a film over and over again, you need that. And Toy Story is one of those that offers that. I think more and more animators or the companies that are producing animation are thinking about how do you hit both.
Yeah.
Well, the
audiences.
Warner Brothers cartoons were the same way. Not every joke was for the kids.
No, they
most
definitely.
Of them were for the adults.
Most of them were for the adults.
They were definitely not.
Another Disney Pixar film is Brave.
My name is Lynn Jaffe, and I'm from Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And my choice is Brave because it's different from the other Disney princess movies. Merida is a girl after my own heart. She's a tomboy. They're trying to make her fit the princess mold and marry her off, and she rebels against that and makes a wish, and it winds up hitting her mother.
Mom? You're a bear! Why a bear?
And if she doesn't find the witch to break the spell, her mother will become permanently a bear. And so it's very humorous of how they interact and hide her mom in the castle and how she winds up saving her mother in the end. But she's got these three little triplet bratty brothers, and they do all kinds of things for comedic relief.
A witch turned mom into a bear. It's not my fault. We've got to get out of the castle. I need your help. Oh, all right. You can have my desserts for 2-3 weeks. Okay, fine. A year.
Did you hear that?
There it goes!
Maybe we should lay a trap.
Maybe you should shut your trap!
From the 2012 film Brave.
And I think it's worth noting that this was written and directed by a woman, Brenda Chapman, although a man took over halfway through the directing process, which was very controversial in certain circles. But, I mean, Disney has to reinvent the female quest princess story. I mean, it just has to happen. It's too antiquated to continue having helpless princesses.
Yeah, but the mother's still getting cursed, though, which I take a little bit personally.
Mothers will always be cursed.
Well, here's one that is actually my favorite.
My name is Cy Kira McCracken. Kira McCracken is my last name, but it's hyphenated. And I'm 7. My favorite movie is Captain Underpants. I like many other movies. Then Captain Underpants, but right now Captain Underpants is my favorite one. I like about it is it's not like all scary. It's not like all like not too scary. It's like really funny because it's like underpants and poopy pants and all that stuff, like potty humor.
Oh no! What do we do? What do we do? What do we do?
Well, what did we used to find funny?
Well, mostly potty humor, poop, vomit, that kind of thing.
Really? Ugh, that is like the lowest form of comedy.
Don't you say that, Harold! Don't you leave me!
Attention, everyone! Oh, I'll probably move on to other planets, Jupiter, Mars. Can't forget Uranus!
Wait, did he just say... your anus?
I know!
Ha-ha! Yeah, that's gross!
Oh, there's more where that came from! Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday!
Unlimited underpants!
I am so...
The final failure for Professor Poopy Pants.
My favorite part is when Captain Underpants drinks... He's in that big toilet and he drinks green tea. And he turns really, really, really muscular. And he saves the day. And then he's like, I have come to save the day. And then Professor Poopy Pants is like, yeah, and I've come to ruin it, so back off,
Sai, you just made everyone's day, my friend. You made everyone's day.
I believe he said Poopy Pants 9 times and Underpants about 13.
My goal was to say Professor Poopy Pants at least 3 times, which I will do if only to increase my Professor Poopy Pants credibility, which I can't even get it out. But what I loved about this film, I would never have seen this. I'm not having kids myself, except for this show, is that it's about this friendship between these two boys who don't fit the mold and who are feeling oppressed by their principal, who's actually this like just lonely guy who needs to have connection in his life. And then Professor Poopy Pants comes in and wants to get rid of laughter, and then the kids have to fight Professor Poopy Pants. And so this was a romp, and Sai was honest about what he liked about it, which was the potty humor, which was, you know.
I believe you said Poopy present. Pants more than Sai.
Thank you.
I'm just stunned into silence.
I love this. I could laugh at this forever. I could laugh at this for the rest of my life.
Single
day.
We might do a whole show.
They might just run loops Captain of this
Underpants.
Kind of thing,
yes.
Like at my funeral. They would just run loops of that, Poopy Pants. And then just the whole, like, with his squints his eyes, and did he say you're...
I don't know why it's charming in the most kind of simple
way. Laura just
way,
held her head.
I know.
She didn't even roll her eyes. She just like dropped
for the record,
her head
Laura is above
into
this
both hands.
Frank
no.
and I are right there with you.
I know this is the grim adult view here is that these people go on to dominate comedy and then turn all of our comedy shows into the same.
We're
kind
gonna take
of humor.
A break. We're gonna take a break because I have. When I see this in live action films, I turn away. It's like not funny to me. Let's take a break. Marcia Gordon, Laura Boys, they are both important people in the world, but I don't have time to tell you what they do. But I have time to say that we're talking about animated films today and movies on the radio, and there's more. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio talking with Marcia Boys and Laura Gordon. Talking with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Marcia is a film professor at NC State. And Laura Boys is the film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. And we're talking today about animated films.
My name is Laura Jackson, and I live in downtown Raleigh. And I'm actually calling from work in Research Triangle Park to talk about this movie. Sita Sings the Blues is a one-woman tour de force. Nina Paley did all the animation and directed it and produced it and wrote it, and she was inspired by her own breakup of her own romance, and she lost her boyfriend to India. And perhaps as a result, she read the Ramayana, which is an ancient South Asian tale of Prince Rama and his wife Sita.
Dear brother Ravana, have you seen Rama's wife Sita? She is the most beautiful woman in the world. Her skin is fair like the lotus blossom. Her eyes are like lotus pools. Her hands are like lotuses. Her breasts like big, round, firm, juicy lotuses. Make Sita your wife, Ravana. Steal her from Rama.
It's a beautifully imaginative cultural mashup of the Ramayana, her own personal story of heartbreak, and the words of a 1920s torch singer who also sings about women's joy and pain in love.
Sweet daddy, even the clock keeps ticking. Daddy, won't you please come home?
Sita Sings the Blues.
And she put this in the public domain so you can watch it for free on all kinds of different platforms. And I recommend it highly.
Yeah, it's a very innovative mix of styles. And it's about something serious and personal and painful. And that is a whole other strain of animation.
Yeah, she's got so many things working through it. It's pretty amazing. American Pop, another fine film.
Hi, my name is Matt Panacci. I'm from Durham, North Carolina, and I selected Ralph Bakshi's 1981 effort American Pop as my memorable animated film. Bakshi, prior to this, had been famous for films such as Fritz the Cat, Heavy Traffic, Coonskin, all of which had loads of social commentary on them, in them, and were fairly off-the-wall, somewhat gonzo films, and definitely memorable films, counterculture films. With this film, he tends to exercise more restraint than he ever had up to this point in his career, And I think by doing so, it allows him to get to the heart of telling his most linear story.
Zalmi should have been a star.
The kid's a genius.
But there were complications. Benny could have been famous, but life got in the way.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe.
Tony had a brush with success.
You the one who writes the songs?
Don't you know I'm nothing without you?
But had to let it go.
I want you to play one of my songs.
So it was up to Pete to grab it, hold it, and make himself heard.
Working on a night move.
And it was the first time that I had noticed, not just with Backsheet, but oftentimes with a lot of filmmakers I admire and respect, that when they exercise restraint is often when they're at their very best as storytellers.
American Pop.
I haven't seen this one for a really long time. It's a multi-generational saga of kind of the history of American popular music. And it seems to have been made in an era where you could afford music clearances, because there's a lot of very familiar music.
Yeah, music. Obviously, we've been talking about music from the start of the show. It's very, very important. And I think of Bakshi as a kind of predecessor of people doing things today, like Anomalisa, Charlie Kaufman's recent really interesting high-tech stop-motion film that's dealing with like very adult kinds of things and just using this particular medium to do it.
Let's move on Movies on the Radio, more animated films.
I'm Brian Hoffman. I'm calling from Raleigh. And my pick is The Triplets of Belleville. The movie itself is such a beautiful movie. And it's so when it's adult, when you see it, you sort of get wrapped up into the surrealness of it. And you don't really miss the dialogue.
I like to be wrinkly, utterly wrinkly, wrinkly like a triplet from Belleville.
And having seen it as an adult, and then to watch it with my stepson and see the message that he gave me was really incredible. It was an incredible moment for me, because then I opened it up. I saw it in a whole different light. And so what my five-year-old friend saw was the grit and determination of this grandmother to find her son.
The Triplets of Belleville, 2003, French film.
This film, I remember when this came out, the aesthetic of it is so cool and unique. I mean, anytime you see an animated film that really develops its own style, Sita Sings the Blues does that, you know, doing kind of hybrid form. But, I mean, the way this film looks and then that beautiful kind of sound, the absence of dialogue and a killer story, yeah, super interesting.
It's so, so good. They actually did it at Duke with live music a year or two ago. It was really amazing. I found this to be very divisive, though, because I took a couple of friends to see it, and for some reason they loathed it and never forgave me for taking me to see this film.
Did they not follow? Was it the storyline? Because that can be.
I don't know what it was.
Wow. They never forgave you.
Talking about its own aesthetic, I think our next film is in some ways an example of that as well.
Hi, I'm Tom McCullum. I'm calling from Fort Bragg. The animated movie I liked the best was Nightmare Before Christmas. I can remember sitting in the theater, and I was just mesmerized by the animation and everything that I saw going on in the screen. Honestly, I'm not a big fan of musicals on movies, but this one just really held my attention. It was unbelievable, everything that I could see and that was happening, and just the imagination and the way they brought it to life with the animation. It was really spectacular.
Kidnap Mr. Sandy Claus?
I want to do it.
Let's draw straws.
Jack said we should work together.
Three of a kind.
Birds of a feather, now and forever.
First, we're going to set some bait inside a nasty trap and wait. When he comes sniffing, we will snap the trap and close the gate.
Wait, I've got a better plan to catch this big red lobster man. Let's pop him in a boiling pot, and when he's done, we'll butter him up.
Kidnap the Sandy Claus, throw him in a box.
Nightmare Before Christmas. That was 1993.
Yeah, based on a Tim Burton story and Tim Burton animations, although directed by someone else. And, you know, Tim Burton has such an unusual, as with kind of, we were talking about Triplets of Belleville and that distinct aesthetic. I mean, you know Tim Burton just by looking at an image, and that carries over into the animation, which, you know, is a great, very creative realization of that kind of gothic aesthetic. And so, yeah, this is...
Well, a gothic Christmas is really a great idea because there are so many sappy Christmas films, and this is the opposite. And the music, of course, is by Danny Elfman, formerly of Oingo Boingo, who is a longtime collaborator with Tim Burton.
And he's a performer in this, too.
He's
right?
a performer, he does the voice the singing voice, not the speaking voice.
And it is interesting because often, I mean, in so many of these films, you've talked about it, you both put your finger on it, the music is critical to some of these. And there are films, honestly, some in this list, and I won't name them, that to my ear, the music was oppressive. I mean, it was just way too much and not quite right. And when it's not right, everything is off, right? You can't even watch it.
I mean, that's true for animated or non-animated films as well, but it does seem to me that in animated films we've been talking about the dominance of music in things like Fantasia, but even in the non-Fantasia, non-all music films, it's so pivotal to the film.
I'm Jill McMillan, and I'm calling from Morrisville, North Carolina. And my pick for the best animated movie is Isao Takahata's Grave of the Fireflies. This is a film about a young boy trying to provide for and keep his sister and himself alive in the aftermath of a bombing in Kobe, Japan. They're completely on their own, and it's heartbreaking in his depiction of trying to provide for his little sister, who's probably about 4 or 5 years old.
Hey, you!
I'm sorry! Sir, forgive me! I didn't mean to! My sister's sick. I just wanted to get her some sugar!
Yeah, sure. Stealing food is a serious crime in wartime. You! What the hell? Potatoes, too? So you're the one who's been stealing my crop!
I'm sorry. I'll never do it again. I swear.
Tell it to the cops. I'll take you there myself. Now
please.
Walk.
No,
I
please.
I hope they lock you up.
Tita.
Please, she's sick.
Tita.
She needs me.
Move.
Tita.
The film is Grave of the Fireflies, 1988. Isao Takahata.
Well, I mean, there's a really interesting tradition of both comics and animated films tackling very, very serious subjects. I'm thinking about like Art Spiegelman and Mouse, which is a graphic novel about the Holocaust, and recent films like Waltz with Bashir or Persepolis that are animated that are dealing with very, very serious subject matter. And obviously dealing with two children trying to survive in a post-bomb Japan is incredibly serious. And what I find interesting about watching those is you would think you would have less of an emotional reaction given the fact that they're not real people performing. But often I find them even more moving for some intangible reason than live-action films.
I think it's because it has a kind of universality. I've also seen a film that actually depicted the bombing of Hiroshima in animation. And you couldn't reproduce that and give it the same kind of emotion in real life that you can in an animated version of it.
So my name is Matthew Booker. I'm calling from Raleigh. I'm an environmental historian, and I'm calling about Princess Mononoke, which is my pick for the best animated film. And at the beginning of the film, Prince Ashitaka's village is invaded by wild boar led by their god, who's infested by a demon. It turns out that the demon also infects Prince Ashitaka, and he is forced to seek a cure for his wound, which leads him to encounter the powerful Lady Eboshi and her clan, who are cutting down the forest to make iron so they can build weapons to kill the forest spirit as part of their war with nature.
What do you think you're doing, boy?
Stay your hand. The girl's life is now mine.
I'm sure she'll make a lovely wife for you.
There's a demon inside of you. It's inside both of you.
everyone. This is what hatred looks like. This is what it does when it catches hold of you. It's eating me alive, and very soon now it will kill me. Fear and anger only make it grow faster.
I'm getting a little bored of this curse of yours, Ashitaka. Let me just cut the damn thing off.
And that's where the film gets really interesting. So Lady Eboshi, for instance, wants to defeat the forest spirit because it's continually sending its monsters and its storms against her people. And she wants to build a city to support the lepers and the prostitutes, the cast-offs from society. There aren't any clear good guys or bad guys in the film, and that's what makes it such a wonderful parable.
Princess Mononoke, released in Japan in 97, here in 99.
And the extreme complexity of the characters makes it a little puzzling because Lady Eboshi has beheads the forest spirit and the forest dies, which is a bad thing. And in a Disney movie, she would be killed. I mean, she even looks like the queen from Snow White. Mm. But she's forgiven and she's allowed to go back and rebuild her town, which is making iron, which is in itself destructive,
right,
to try to do it better the second time around.
Yeah, and as my esteemed colleague at NC State, Dr. Booker, just pointed out, this is a morally complicated, very politically engaged film that takes place in a world of conflict and violence. Imagine that. And yet it does so with these kind of fantastic ideas. So it has this allegorical quality to it. And I think it's just interesting to reflect on the fact that we've been talking about nature films from the start of the show. And this film is dealing with it in a much more political way. It's deforestation and it's, you know, greed and it's modernity and all these other
things. It's the inherent paradox of civilization.
Yes.
And it's captured maybe in a way that only animation can do. I really want to get to this next film because I loved most of these films. Like, in a way, I was introduced to these films. This one blew me away.
This is Jeff Gott from Chapel Hill. And my pick for one of my favorite animated movies, it's actually a short film, and it's by Alexander Alexeyev and Claire Parker. And it's the story, The Nose, which is a short story by Nikolai Gogol. So it's a short film, but it's done in a very, very original style. It's created using pin screens, which are basically pins that are embedded in a mesh that you can push in and out, and they can form pictures by capturing light. Depending on what position you put them in, they could be in shadow. So you end up creating what ends up looking like an etching, which is animated, but it's quite beautiful. And because it's done in this very strange way, it almost seems like you're looking at a dream. And it actually lends itself really well to the story, because the story is a very surrealistic story about a guy who wakes up one morning and his nose has disappeared, and the nose, actually away from his face, leads its own life.
Lene, I had not seen this before. It's about 11 and a half minutes. You can see it on YouTube. Dazzling.
Yeah, the surrealist strain in animation, I think, is one of the most kind of powerful. I'm thinking of a Czech animator right now named Jan Švankmajer, yeah, who mixes often live action with animation and also does his own animations. And you can create the most disturbing, yeah, wonderful universes with animation in a lot of different animation styles. And so I had not seen this film until the show either. It's fantastic.
Just to see it, you cannot figure out how it was done.
You can't get farther from,
yes,
Professor Poopy Pants, and yet my two favorite were those two.
Good on you, Frank.
And you are my two favorite film critics. Thank you,
aww,
so much.
Thank
Laura
you.
Boys and Marcia Gordon. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State. Laura, the curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. We're going to do our favorite movies from the year 2017 as a special holiday treat. So send us an email at stateofthings.sot@wnc.org, and then you can tell us what your favorite film is, and we'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.